How can we envision the sweeping changes to entire landscapes?
Ownership of commons, the air, soils, water, biological diversity.
Cultural diversity is as critical as biological disorientation.
In this epic struggle to preserve a habitable
planet, that is the only thing which is sustainable.
The place that you love is now under siege.
Deregulated commerce is becoming a threat to the life on this planet.
These are system problems.
Our humanity is at
stake. We shouldn't ask whether we can survive.
These are existential questions as much as they are systemic questions.
Action informed by knowledge of place.
You're listening to the Schumacher Lectures, a channel hosted by the Schumacher Center for New Economics. The Schumacher Lectures feature speakers who challenge entrenched ways of thinking while exploring how to build a new economy that serves both people and the planet.
Any public program to preserve land or produce food is hopeless if it does not tend to right the balance between numbers of people and acres of land, and to encourage long-term stable connections between families and small farms.
David Orr delivered his speech, Walking North on a Southbound Train, in October 2002.
Let's have a look at it.
Nancy, thank you for those kind words. As with most introductions, I'm appreciative of the words, but also for the things she could have said and didn't say. She knows me well enough to say a number of really nasty things. Boy, it's a danger putting a preacher's kid into a pulpit. We're going to have an altar call at some time. Susan and I talked about that earlier, and she agreed to split the proceeds that come from an altar call and the offering. It's a real pleasure to be here, even on kind of a somber day. And I would like to say a couple things before I get started. I don't want to talk about greeting the campus. That's the talk I had been asked to give and agreed to give, and I'd like to change the subject and talk about the context in which campuses might be greened. So I want to talk about politics. I'd like to start and say that I'd like to dedicate what I say to not just the memory of Paul Wellstone, but to the causes he represented so well. And so this is to Paul Wellstone. The title, if I had to give this a title, would be taken from Peter Montagu's Environment and Health Weekly, number 570, in which he had a description of walking north on a southbound train. And so with apologies to Peter, I'd like to title what I'm going to say, Walking North on a Southbound Train. And I'd like to talk about politics, and I'd like to begin with a couple of comments about this. There was a recent study, October 18th, described in the New York Times about the increase of autism in California. And autism is an interesting disease. It has to do with the inability to form relationships, and frequently it's coupled with extraordinary mathematic ability. And there has been an increase in autism in California, probably throughout the country, and I'd like to illustrate that with a story which describes kind of political autism that we see around us. We have congressmen who can count campaign contributions but have difficulty in forming relationships with constituents. And that's part of our problem. Let me illustrate that with this story. This is taken from an item I got on the internet back a few years ago, and it's about Andy McCoola living in Dixon City near Scranton, Pennsylvania. He received a bill for his as-yet-unused credit card stating that he owed 0.00. He ignored it and threw it away. In April, Andy received another, and he threw that one away too. The following month, the credit card company sent him a very nasty note stating they were going to cancel his card if he didn't send them 0.00 by return post. He called them. He talked to them. They said it was a computer error and told him they'd take care of it. The following month, Andy decided it was about time he tried out the troublesome credit card, figuring that if there were purchases on his account, it would put an end to his ridiculous predicament. However, in the first store that he produced his credit card in payment for his purchases, he found that his card had been canceled. So he called the credit card company, who apologized for it, for the computer error, and said that they would take care of it. The next day, he got a bill for 0.00, stating that payment was now overdue. Assuming that having spoken to the credit card company only the previous day, the latest bill was yet another mistake. He ignored it, trusting that the company would be as good as their word and sort the problem out. The next month, he got a bill for 0.00, stating that he had 10 days to pay his account, or the company would have to take steps to recover the debt. Finally giving in, he thought he would beat the company at their own game and mailed them a check for 0.00. The computer duly processed his account and returned a statement to the effect that he now owed the credit card company nothing at all. A week later, Andy McCullough's bank called him, asked him what he was doing, writing a check for 0.00. After a lengthy explanation, the bank replied that the 0.00 check had caused their check processing software to fail. The bank could not now process any checks from any of their customers that day because the check for 0.00 was causing the computer to crash. The following month, Andy received a letter from the credit card company claiming that his check had bounced. And he now owed them 0.00. And unless he sent a check by return of post, they'd be taking steps to recover their debt. Political autism. Familiar? Now, the problem we have, and I want to talk a bit about this, is a kind of political autism between us as people and the political decision-making machinery. And the things that connect the two are broken, and that is, I think, the crisis of our time. I don't think anybody gets up in the morning and says, I intend to ruin the planet today. But today I'm going to pave over some more farmland, add carbon to the atmosphere and change the climate, or drive species into extinction. No one really says that, but that's what we do. All right, okay, Dick Cheney, maybe. Hey, Susan, am I allowed to be political? If this gets too hot and heavy, we can just turn a hymn 20 up here and take out the hymnals, and we'll sing. Ken Kesey has a great little vignette and his sometimes a great notion in which there's a dog tethered to a pole in a yard, and his dog food is there within the radius of the tether, and a fox comes to the edge of the clearing, and a fox begins to run in circles around the tether. The dog, of course, follows, and the tether gets shorter and shorter with each lap around. When the tether is finally short enough, the fox struts in, calmly eats the dog's food, and leaves. Now, I think that's a story for our time. Somebody's run us in circles, somebody's tied us up, and somebody's eaten our lunch. And it's time, I think, that we ask who, why, and what do we do about it. So I'm going to talk about politics, and I'm going to begin with what we know. And the things that we know, I think, are the following. First, I think that we know that we're losing ground. We're certainly not winning in this epic struggle to preserve a habitable planet. Every ecosystem you know, every place that you love is now under siege. Population growth in the 20th century went up 3 times. Energy use, perhaps 10 times. The economy grew, perhaps by 5 times. We're now, as all of us in the room know, in a process of biotic impoverishment. Climate change will alter every ecosystem on the planet within a matter of decades. On the horizon are other threats that we haven't yet dealt with: nanotechnologies, genetic engineering, artificial intelligence. We're not prepared even to talk about those. We're losing ground in what can only be called an epic struggle between life and death. Second, I think that all of us in the room know that the forces of denial are stronger now and more brazen than they have ever been. Millions hear every day that you and I are kind of wackos for 4 hours a day on Rush Limbaugh. We're being identified by the extreme right increasingly as terrorists. And if that wasn't enough, we still spend about $300 billion a year to lie to each other through advertising, the most clever things that we do on the planet. Third, we're caught between two fundamentalisms. We can identify the fundamentalism of Osama bin Laden, and that is fundamentalism. It's harder for us to see as a nation the fundamentalism built in the World Trade Organization and the perpetual growth economy. One fundamentalism says no change ever for anyone unless we, the likes of religious fundamentalists, agree to it and decide how and where to do it. The other says all change for everyone all the time, and we're caught between the two. We're in that free fire zone between two different kinds of fundamentalism. Ours is now magnified by the thinking that went into an organization called the Project for a New American Century. Each kind of fundamentalism requires, it demands, dependably loathsome enemies on the other side. And environment, peace, and justice are no part of either fundamentalism or any other kind of fundamentalism. Jimmy Carter recently said in an op-ed piece in the Washington Post that there is a core group of conservatives who are trying to realize long pent-up ambitions under the cover of the proclaimed war against terrorism. Jimmy Carter is a man of great moderation. There's a fourth thing I think that we know, and that is that we live in a time of massive failure of democracy. Democracy here and elsewhere is failing. Civil liberties here are certainly under assault. We live in a time in which democracy is being replaced by plutocracy. Jeff Gates, who analyzes financial issues, I think, as acutely as anybody I know, says that the top 1% now, the top 1% in America, control 95% of the financial wealth of the country. During the decade of the 1990s, the wealth of the 400 billionaires in the United States grew, on average, each day, by $2 million. Globally, in 1960, the ratio of the richest to the poorest was 30 to 1. That ratio is now 74 to 1. We ought to ask why that is the case and why that economic growth, which is touted as the answer to inequity, hasn't produced inequity. To the contrary, it's produced vast inequity. None of this is an accident. And I think, fifth, that we know that the situation we now face is part of a deliberate and long-term strategy. David Stockman, who was Ronald Reagan's director of the Office of Management and Budget, wrote a book in the early 1980s after his term of office had ended, which he described the Republican strategy, and it was simply to raise military spending, lower corporate taxes, create a fiscal crisis, and force Congress to cut social programs. That strategy, I think we know, is still intact. And as part of it, we know that this project for a new American century, which Dick Cheney is a part, has magnified all of these other issues. The strategy is now for to take over essentially the world as an American empire. Sixth, I think we can say definitively that we passed a watershed, or certainly approaching a watershed in U.S. history. Whether you think that the election of 2000 was a coup, as my Congressman Sherrod Brown believes it was, or not, it certainly was a transition to a very different political era. I think, seventh, we can say that worse is probably on the way. Worldwide, at the UN summit in Johannesburg in August, numbers were put out about the fate of children in the world. 250 million children, roughly the size of the U.S. population, now work as virtual slaves for global corporations. Millions more are exposed to incredible violence in Africa, the Middle East, Balkans, Northern Ireland, vicariously and otherwise here in the United States. We now have a generation of children growing up without anything we could identify as a decent childhood. I think we know that these are no longer problems that will respond to tinkering kind of solutions at the margin. These are system problems. These are problems that go well past the kind of solutions we typically talk about. They're not coefficient problems. These are not problems that can be solved by changing the rate at which things get worse. And finally, I think that we know, and all of us know, in a place like this, we ought to realize and ought to act on the belief that the world still is rich in good possibilities. We're in failure mode. Why is that so? I think we're in failure mode as a movement because first we talk ideas and theories and concepts while they do politics. While we confer, they're down at the truck stop. While we've been getting in touch with our inner child, they've been getting in touch with Middle America. While we argue among ourselves, they're taking over the court system. Second, I think we're in failure mode because for 20 years, at least, we've had a strategy of being cautious and reasonable, putting arguments in their terms. We talk about natural capital as if nature can be reduced to the language of economics. We talk about nature services, having bought a utilitarian view of the world. We play on their playing field by their rules. They want us to be rigorous and safe and cautious and miss the point by never talking to the public. Third, I think we're in failure mode because they have learned to play to the fears and resentments that are endemic in rapidly changing societies, in a society where women begin to move into positions of power and authority, minorities become prominent, children have different aptitudes and attitudes than they did 50 years ago. Fears and resentments become widespread. They've learned to play to those fears and resentments. Fourth, I think we're in failure mode because, like European socialists of the 19th century, we've divided up into factions. If you know anything about that history, you know that Proudhon didn't like Marx. Marx didn't like anyone else. No one liked anybody on the left. And by the time the world was ready and able for better answers on how to organize industrial society, what we got was Bolshevism. And the rest, as they say, is history. Like the 19th century European socialists, we're divided into greens, light greens, deep greens, shallow greens, deeply shallow light greens, ordinary environmentalists, old line conservationists, Naderites, left Democrats, labor women, environmentalists, gays, and mothers against any number of things. We're divided. This leads us to adopt a strategy once defined by David Brower as circling the wagons and shooting inward. Fifth, we're in failure mode, I think, because of a certain kind of complacency that dogs us. And I don't know whether it's a fear of success or what. Environmental writer Jack Turner puts it this way. Why don't people speak out? Why don't they do something? We are a nation of environmental cowards. Why? Because effective protest is grounded in anger, and we're not consciously angry. Anger nourishes hope, fuels rebellion. It presumes judgment, presumes how things ought to be and are not, presumes a caring. Emotion remains the best evidence of belief and value. Unfortunately, there is little connection between our emotions and the wild. I think, sixth, we're in failure mode because we didn't understand, most of us did not understand, the depth of our problems and hence could not offer real solutions. Herman Daly once put it that we have an infinite itch as a species and we don't know where to scratch. I think part of that depth would cause us to come to grips with death in a much more realistic kind of way. Ernest Becker in wonderful writings back in 1970 and 1974. A book called The Denial of Death describes the lengths to which we go to deny mortality. We find our way around mortality and transcendence and patriotism and religion and all kinds of other sorts of things. Carl Jung, in his discussion of archetypes decades or half a century ago, described how those deeper layers, kind of the archaeology of the human psyche, was important in our daily actions in ways we don't fully appreciate. Buddhists would see our problems rooted in the systemic and systematic cultivation of greed, illusion, and ill will, the multiplication of wants in a society and an economy that will never satisfy and is not intended to satisfy those wants. Solutions will have to go deeper. They'll have to go to celebration and self-denial and to a realistic perception of human personality. But I think we're failing because we fail to realize the depth of the movement we've raised. What's to be done? Who will act? Well, I've run my own personal flag up the flagpole of education. I would hope that educational organizations will begin at all levels to respond to this. This is part of the greening of the campus movement and greening of education generally. Who else will act? Well, so far it hasn't been Congress, not likely to be corporations. It hasn't been governments generally. I think education can lead, but the first point I'd like to make is that we are part of the problem. Thomas Berry puts it this way. As now functioning the university, and you could substitute here, I think, public education as well, prepares students for their role in extending human domination over the natural world, not for intimate presence to the natural world. Use of this power in a deleterious manner has devastated the planet. So awesome is the devastation we're bringing about that we can only conclude that we're caught in a severe cultural disorientation. A disorientation that is sustained intellectually by the university, economically by the corporation, legally by the Constitution, spiritually by religious institutions. We are, in short, part of the problem. To become part of the solution, greening the campus must be premised on some changes. And the first change would be to see education once again not as a small technical subject, but as a big concept. Education ought to lead us to a more full human stature. It ought to raise the issues of where are we? What kind of species are we? What will we be when we grow up? This is not a subject for SAT scores and technical information. Education was once a large concept. From Plato through John Dewey and the writings of Alfred North Whitehead, education was taken as a big concept, as a big subject. Every major philosopher wrote about it. We, on the contrary, have formed institutions that are designed all wrong. And to follow Nancy's comment about ecological design, how would we design institutions, in this case colleges and universities, that are capable of designing ecologically? We've created specialized disciplines and fields and subdisciplines, increasingly arcane language, people cut off from all kinds of other things. We're more famous for conversations we do not have than conversations that we do have. We tend to look inward. We look for intellectual guidance to Tokyo or London or Paris or whatever, but seldom do we engage local communities. A quarter inch off virtually any college campus in the country, there are drug problems, there are economic problems, there are severe human problems which we ignore. Very seldom are faculty rewarded for addressing those problems, either practically or intellectually. We're rewarded for publishing in a small number of unread journals, articles that are esoteric and knowledge begins to develop. What is known in one field often operates contrary to the assumptions and knowledge in another field. What economists know about the physical world is not what physicists know. What economists assume about human behavior, most ethicists and religious philosophers and scholars would find repugnant. There will have to be change. There can be no solution without a public whose discretion has been better informed, as Thomas Jefferson once put it. And this is where the Green Campus movement fits in. The idea of a green campus is ideal because this reduces the scale of solutions to a problem to a size that the mind can embrace. We can get our minds around issues of purchasing, issues of climate neutrality, issues of environmental impacts. We can study them and use campuses as laboratories for change. And that broadly informed citizenry, those 14 million college students, could become the advance guard of a very different world order. Campuses might also help us take back language. Our stock in trade is reportedly good thinking. Good thinking depends on the clear use of language. How was it that the word patriot came to describe someone, usually one person, in an oversized sport utility vehicle with two American flags attached to it and a God Bless America bumper sticker on their way to the shopping mall? That is not a patriot. How is it that the word conservative came to apply to people willing to run risks with the entire health of the planet? That's not conservative. How is it that the word resources came to apply to nature or to humans as human resources? We might help take back language as a basis for remaking the world. But more is going to be required of us. We have to take back courts. We have to take back Congress. We have to take back the Constitution. While we're at it, we ought to rethink corporate charters. We ought to have the same standard for corporations, that three strikes and you're out standard that we have for common criminals. It's time to go back and rethink that pernicious Supreme Court decision of 1886, the Santa Clara County decision, by which corporations were given the legal rights of persons. And all those rights in the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment of due process. Now, you and I are persons, but we're mortal. Our assets are not infinite. Corporations have no such limitations. We ought to resuscitate the citizenry. Remember back in American history, the 1858 debates of Lincoln and Douglas. There were eight of them. And those common farmers came out to hear Lincoln and Douglas. And if you look at the full version of the debates, you can see that they followed those debates. There was laughter, there was applause. They were engaged in those debates, probably standing up, nowhere near the comfort that we typically enjoy. The debates went on for hours sometimes. There were allusions to classical traditions. There were all kinds of things in intellectual use. There was actually an argument in those debates. People followed it, and they listened to it. And they didn't get it quite right, necessarily, but they took it seriously. Think of our time now in which we have politics by sound bites. As the issues have become larger and more salient and larger in scope and extending further in time, our attention span has dropped dramatically. We need a new kind of politics. The terms left and right don't describe our situation anymore. Left and right, as somebody, maybe Kirk Sale once said, are really more like a horseshoe. It's bent around so that the extreme left and extreme right are very much alike each other. We need to recognize that politics isn't left versus right. It's present and future. We need a politics that works, as the Iroquois once had it, seven generations out. We need a politics that reconnects our will as people with the machinery of government. So public policy, in fact, does represent what we want. And one of the strange perversions of our time, the National Rifle Association has been able to block effective gun control legislation. While a majority, a consistent large majority in this country favor gun control. And so you have the idiocy last week of Charlton Heston up here in New Hampshire with, what's his phrase, over my cold, dead body, holding that rifle over his head. But also on the front page, it was, the sixth or eighth killing by the sniper. The idiocy of the time. We need to reconnect public will with public decisions. We need economic reforms. We need to end subsidies, that $300 billion in subsidies we give each year to the automobile while complaining about a pittance to Amtrak and public transportation. or that figure of $1.4 trillion that Norman Myers estimates worldwide operates as perverse subsidies, of which $210 billion is given to fossil fuels and the nuclear industry. We need economic reforms that once again assign ownership of commons, the air, the airwaves, soils, water, biological diversity, back to the public and to future generations. Thank you. We need to rethink taxes in this country, that top 1% that controls 95% of the financial wealth of the country. That needs to be undone. Bush's tax cut, according to Paul Krugman, is more responsible for the slowdown in the U.S. economy than anything else, including the war on terrorism. We need to open up government. The very idea that energy policy in this country, arguably the most important long-term policy that we'll ever have, was formed behind closed doors by the vice president and representatives of Enron Corporation. We need to posit a strategy. Most of us know what we're against in this movement, but what are we for? We need a recalibration of how or what we intend in the world, with how the world works as a physical system. That's ecological design. But that's not about stopping things, per se, although there are lots of things that ought to be stopped. That's about starting things. How do we begin a revolution in the way we make the human presence in the world? Janine Benyus' wonderful little book, Biomimicry. In one part, Janine describes how spiders take dead flies and sunshine and make materials stronger than Kevlar, the material from which we make bulletproof vests. Ambient temperature, no fossil fuels, no sulfuric acid, made at or near the body, biodegradable. That's biomimicry. That's a very different kind of world. John Todd in ecological engineering has led that part of the revolution to see how we take nature and can be informed by nature to purify water, grow foods, grow fuels, and do other things. Ray Anderson, Interface Carpet Corporation, decided some years ago to make Interface a leader in the products and services movement. So Interface Carpet goes back to be made into new carpet. You begin to think about the way in which that revolutionizes everything else that falls from it. That the resource flow doesn't start Saudi Arabian crude, manufacturer, customer, landfill. It goes manufacturer, customer, back to manufacturer. That changes foreign policy. We need something to get back to the depth problem, akin to a spiritual revolution. Toward the end of his life, Lewis Mumford, in his last major work, comes to the end of his second volume, cannot see a way to get past our time without beginning to re-engage the world of spirit at a small scale. No amount of cleverness is going to help us. We'll need to transform ourselves as we transform the world. And then finally, we need to rethink what leadership is all about. Recently, Václav Havel, the Czech president who's about to leave office, said this in the New York Review of Books. In time, I have become a good deal less sure of myself, a good deal more humble. Every day I suffer more and more from stage fright. Every day I'm more afraid that I won't be up to the job. More and more often, I'm afraid that I will fall woefully short of expectations, that I will somehow reveal my own lack of qualifications for the job, that despite my good faith, I'll make ever greater mistakes, that I will cease to be trustworthy and therefore lose the right to do what I do. Václav Havel. Imagine leaders with that kind of humility. People of conscience, people of conviction, people of energy, people of ideas, but informed by the perception of their own fallibility. Imagine, too, leaders willing to go to ground zero, and I don't mean lower Manhattan, I mean ground zero Hiroshima, or to Bhopal, and say to the people of those places, we're sorry, never again. Imagine those same leaders looking forward 1,000 years and identifying places like the Harappan region in India, deforested thousands of years ago, or the Aral Sea, or the Mediterranean, or the Chesapeake Bay, and selecting those as millennium sites to be restored to full health over what might take 1,000 years. That seems far distant from our time full of strutting leaders, mad bombers, snipers, and terrorists. But we've known dark times before, and now we're called to have the courage to know that we must do, in our time, great work, as Thomas Berry says. To do great work requires a certain kind of boldness, perhaps foolhardiness. I love Marshal Foch's comment, reportedly at the Second Battle of the Marne in 1917, in which he said he radioed back to headquarters that his center was giving way, his left had collapsed, but the situation was excellent. I am attacking. 1,000 years hence, the time span, I think, in which E.F. Schumacher talked, we would hope that our descendants, our great, 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 great grandchildren, will look back at our time and say that we did get it right in our time, that we turned things around, that we did win the epic struggle for life in all of its full forms. And at this, as Winston Churchill once put it, this was our finest hour. Imagine a time when that southbound train reverses course. And imagine just for a while what the world could be like then and the role that the Schumacher Society will play in this. But as E.F. Schumacher said at the end of his Guide for the Perplexed, we shouldn't ask whether we can survive or not. We ought, as he said, to put these perplexities behind us and get down to work. Thank you.
In any case, it's certainly worth a hell of a try because it's all positive development anyway.
To hear more talks like this one and discover more than 30 years of Schumacher lectures, visit centerfornew.org. The Schumacher Center for New Economics Research Library houses the collections of E.F. Schumacher, Robert Swan, and other influential thinkers in the new economy movement. You can strengthen our mission by purchasing a copy of your favorite Schumacher lectures at centerforneweconomics.org/order-pamphlets. Our work is supported by listeners like you. You can donate to our cause at centerforneweconomics.org/donate. This library and the Schumacher Lectures capture powerful voices for economic reform, voices with the strength to move and inspire. They frame and inform action, but are not themselves the action. At a time when our earth is in crisis and our communities face complex challenges, we are all charged with creating solutions. The Schumacher Center's applied work seeks to implement the principles described by these speakers within the context of the Berkshire Hills of Massachusetts. This work includes crafting innovative leases that share equity and improvements while holding land in community trust, building Berkshares, a local currency designed to democratize monetary issue and keep money circulating in the region, and engaging citizens in supporting the development of regionally appropriate businesses, creating local jobs while retaining local ownership and control. You can support our work in a new economy by making a donation at centerforneweconomics.org/donate or call us at 413-528-1737 to make an appointment to visit our research library and office at 140 Jug End Road, Great Barrington, Massachusetts.